welcome to The Wire, Community and Indigenous Radio's National Independent Current Affairs Program. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. Today, new research backs up that we should definitely not feed online trolls. Artificial intelligence is filling the gap in the aged care system. The plight of borders across borders. There's increased pressure to let students come home for the holidays. Music supporting culture in Roebourne. And Read My Frustration brings attention to the struggles of people living with dyslexia. Stay with us for the next half hour. First up, what's making news? Annie Haswell joins me now.
Hi, Sarah. Well, I'll start today with job figures because it's the story that's dominating the headlines. A slight fall in the jobless figures has got the country very excited. It went down from 7.5% in July to 6.8% in August, which means that 110,000 jobs have been created. But on the back of that, a lot of others are disappearing, particularly in universities. There are mass sheddings happening. At the ANU, over 450 staff will be let go. Sydney Uni has flagged 500, just to name a couple. And there are rumours today that as many as 1,100 will be going from RMIT. The Tertiary Education Union has already estimated losses of 11,000 permanent jobs in the sector and many, many more casual jobs. So what we're seeing really is an emptying out of the country's intellectual capital.
And on to COVID, what are the statistics looking like today?
Well, worldwide, 29.7 million cases, with getting close to a million deaths, 939,000 at the moment, with over 4,000 added overnight. In Australia, some reasonably good news, things slowing down, almost 27,000 cases, 824 deaths with 8 overnight. Victoria has recorded its lowest increase in coronavirus cases in about 3 months, though. The state reported 28 new infections overnight and 8 further deaths.
And to an alarming story about birds dropping from the sky.
Sad story. It's happening on the west coast of America, where there's also terrible fires, which could connect the two things. Thousands of migrating birds have inexplicably died, and the ornithologists are describing it as a national tragedy. They're falling to the earth, and they look like they've virtually starved to death. And there are quite a few theories around. One of them is that they're avoiding the fires, they've been forced to go inland, and they just haven't been able to find enough food. Large avian mortalities or large mortalities like this during migration are rare, and there's few that have ever been as large as this one. They've got records that go back to the 1800s, and they are usually associated with extreme weather events such as a drop in temperature or, in this case, possibly fires.
As self-driving cars come ever closer, a landmark decision.
Yes, well, we all heard about the self-driving car a couple of years ago that failed to notice a person on a bike. And Elaine Hertzberg, who was 49, was hit by the car as she wheeled her bicycle across the road in Arizona, and she died. Investigators have now charged the backup driver of that Uber self-driving car that killed the pedestrian with negligent homicide. So it seems to be that Uber's not responsible, the car's not responsible, but the driver is. So it sort of puts a big question mark over the whole idea of self-driving cars. And in fact, Arizona has stopped all testing since then.
And news from the Kimberley.
Also this week, news broke that the founding member of the Native Title Council, the Kimberley Land Council, very high-profile Aboriginal council, has withdrawn from the National Native Title Council. KLC CEO Nolan Hunter says the decision was prompted by the council focusing on technicalities and lacking teeth.
KLC was involved in setting up the NNTC. And the basis for the NNTC is we started out of a major offensive with protesting against the American mining company on sacred grounds. And people were chucked in jail. There were threatened death threats. There were all sorts of things. And I think sometimes we're a bit worried about appeasing the people too much. You know, you don't get your rights recognized if you just wait for the good conscience and goodwill of the people. You have to fight for it. And we needed to be more proactive in that area. What was my disappointment? You know, the Kimberley Land Council disappointment is that we tried to be patient, we bided our time, we were involved in all the submission stuff, but then we realized that it's far too tame. And we needed to progress things in our own right, in our own region, in the Kimberleys, because the issues that all the evidence in Australia points to the fact that there's this massive statistical deficiency for Aboriginal people that people are happy to accept. Nobody makes big noises about it. There's the odd cry here and there, but, you know, like, and not to say that nobody still advocates for these things, but I'm saying when it came to the National Native Title Council, we needed it to be this powerful body that could really raise the profile of its attention to the discussions at a political level and other things. I didn't see that.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
COVID-19 has been hard on all Australian school students, with lockdowns and kids having to study from home. But children who need to travel between state borders have found it especially difficult. Recently, Queensland granted an exemption for boarding school students and their parents from New South Wales to cross into their state without having to isolate for 14 days. But other state borders across Victoria, South Australia and the Northern Territory still pose a problem for rural parents and children. With National Cabinet on tomorrow, there are hopes more exemptions can be made in time for the school holidays. National Radio News political reporter Amanda Kopp spoke to the Federal Minister for Regional Education, Andrew Gee, and asked what the problem is with opening the borders now.
The problem at the moment is that we have a mishmash of regulations and exemptions that are a bureaucrat's picnic but a nightmare for Australian families.
With the Queensland border, obviously that issue has been solved. So what are the other borders that are still causing problems?
We still had the issue of Queensland students boarding in New South Wales, and they still have to undergo the strict government-allocated quarantine. Now, I'm also told from parents on the ground that New South Wales is working on exemptions for Victorian students studying in New South Wales, which is also very positive news.
So with these kids, they're on isolated properties often. You know, there's very little COVID transmission. So why are they actually being blocked at the border or still having to go through all of these quarantine restrictions?
Well, that's what the parents can't understand. And the rules are so different. So, for example, New South Wales has stipulations that if you're coming into New South Wales, you have to pass through an airport, i.e. Sydney, before you can go home. I mean,
That's a bit useless if you live out in Broken Hill.
Yeah, and so these students are coming from boarding schools, which are pretty COVID safe anyway, and they're then going to areas, by and large, in the country, some really isolated, that are COVID-free anyway. So why force them to fly through Sydney? Why force them again if they're coming from, for example, outback New South Wales and they're trying to get into South Australia?
Obviously, you're talking to parents on the ground who are actually experiencing this in real time. So what are some of the stories that you've heard from them?
For example, some have had to go back to isolation and can only come out twice a day for 10 minutes at a time. I mean, we don't treat prisoners like that in some cases. I've had students having to quarantine multiple times this year in those very harsh conditions. We've had issues with the quarantining not being age appropriate. So, good grief, why would we want to lock up students, kids, for most of the day? You've really got to think about the mental toll that this is taking on our young people on top of everything else that they have been through. And when you go to the states and say, well, we've got a problem here, they'll say, oh, well, we have exemptions and that they can apply for and that should sort them out. But the exemptions aren't being uniformly applied. So some people get them and some people don't.
Yeah. And so, I mean, with how difficult this is for parents, are there any parents who are just simply saying, you know what, it's all too hard, I'm pulling my kid out of school and just teaching them from home?
Yeah, absolutely. There are parents who are doing that. And we've heard stories about that, where it's just all too hard to work through. And so some kids aren't actually returning to school at all. And there's a real issue with Indigenous students not getting back to school. And that is an issue which troubles me greatly. And so we've got some real challenges here in terms of the disruption that this is causing to their learning. Getting these kids to and from school across borders shouldn't be something that's insurmountable. It should be something that we as a nation are able to do. And it just seems, you know, to a lot of these families that we can move heaven and earth when we want to, for example, for footy people. But for everyday people, they've got to jump through all of these bureaucratic hoops.
So we do have National Cabinet meeting tomorrow. What are you hoping to see from that? Are you just hoping to see consensus or kind of a long-term solution for these students?
Yeah, we want a clear set of caring, compassionate and common sense guidelines that everyone understands and everyone can work to. And I don't think that that is too much to ask. We just need to make sure that it's uniform and uniformly applied, that we don't have these terrible border anomalies that are occurring at the moment and these really adverse outcomes where students are being left stranded in state. And please do something. That's what I'm asking.
Minister, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Amanda.
Andrew Gee, Minister for Regional Education, speaking with National Radio News political reporter Amanda Kopp. Australia's aged care system is currently under the microscope, with the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety's interim report finding the sector fails to meet the needs of its older, vulnerable citizens. It does not deliver uniformly safe and quality care, and in too many instances, it neglects older people. A few weeks ago on The Wire, we learnt about Billy, artificial intelligence technology which tracks the daily habits and movements of an elderly person, alerting both the provider and family if habits and movements change. Today, The Wire's Soph Landau speaks with Jason Waller, CEO of Perth-based artificial intelligence company IntelliCare, about how their technology is supporting both healthcare workers and aged care residents.
Using artificial intelligence and our passive sensors, we learn what's normal behaviour in the home. It sends out alerts to family members and caregivers when something's out of the ordinary. So over about a week, it learns what that normal behaviour is. But also significantly, detection's one thing, but prevention's the other thing. Looking at our data and inside the app, you can see long-term trends. So, for instance, we've seen people who have had increased bathroom visits at night, and that can point to a urinary tract infection. An unchecked UTI can end up in worse infection and delirium's are a cause of a fall. By detecting that and looking for that trend early in the piece, you can intervene rather than end up in a situation where you're hospitalised and you're no longer able to look after yourself independently.
It's quite understandable why a lot of people do want to stay at home. Is this a view that your organisation has, that aged care shouldn't be sort of the norm, that people should be able to stay in their homes for longer?
Absolutely. Residential aged care shouldn't be the normal pattern. It was the pattern for a while when we had the war generation. They would retire, go to a retirement village and ultimately end up in a nursing home. People today, their stronger preference is to stay independent and live in their own home. And more to the point, with the growing influx of baby boomers, our economy can't support the ageing population. Aged care in a residential sense is very expensive. 80% of the aged care budget goes towards that, but only supports 20% of the population who require that aged care support. So economically speaking, it makes sense to stay in your own home, and that's the preference of people in the first place. Unfortunately, when they want to do that, the main technology they turn to stay safe is like a duress pendant, and people don't use those. In 80% of falls, people either didn't press the pendant or they didn't have it on them or it wasn't charged, and particularly if they're having early onset dementia, it's not something they remember to do. But using passive sensors and our smart home technology, it doesn't require that intervention from the homeowner. They can get on with their day and do their thing, and the sensors will take care of themselves. By doing that, you have a lower cost approach to aged care rather than having the high cost residential approach, which is still needed for some people. It's not to say it's one or the other, but it's getting the right mix that's important.
How could this AI technology be used in the facilities themselves?
There's two key issues that staff often face. One is people going to the bathroom more at night and ensuring they've returned safely to their bed and haven't had a fall in the bathroom. And secondly, to ensure that they aren't wandering the halls if they do have, for instance, dementia and disturbing other residents of the facility. So with our sensors, we can track both those activities, and we have a dashboard that allows carers at a central location to monitor what's occurring. But the higher order benefit those organisations receive is they get better longitudinal data on how that person is behaving. That allows them to adjust their care model.
What do you see over the next few years of trends of people taking on technology like this?
What we've seen is an acceleration in the technology adoption curve. So in general, there's always those barriers that people have to adopting new technology, and particularly with the elderly. But that's been overcome to quite a large degree, and I think it's probably accelerated that by 2 to 5 years. I think you'll see this has become the norm. Besides the fact that it actually provides that ability to provide better care, economically speaking, the country and many other countries have no other choice but to start to use technology to add on to that human touch. It's not a supplanting of it. It's an additional element that allows the human carer to be more productive.
IntelliCare CEO Jason Waller speaking with The Wire's Soph Landau. A new study has found that internet trolling is more likely to be perpetrated by men who exhibit high levels of psychopathy and sadism. Researchers from Federation University Australia found trolls largely lacked self-control and empathy and tended to be deceitful, callous, and thrill-seeking. What causes someone to enjoy inflicting pain on other people while personally refusing to take responsibility for their actions? The Wire's Jared McLaughlin spoke with researcher Dr. Evita March.
Trolling really is an umbrella term for a variety of different online behaviours. Some antisocial, some could be quite innocuous. This was also based on not only from participant feedback, which I found there was quite a discrepancy, but also in the scientific literature. So when I would explore different studies of trolling, some would present trolling examples as quite innocuous comments, whereas other comments would be really inflammatory and insightful and hateful. So it became apparent to me that not only is there discrepancy among the public, how they define trolling, there was also discrepancy among researchers. So we decided to really scale that all back, and we did a qualitative study that was published in 2019. And in that study, we determined the nominological network of trolling, which is a really fancy word for saying different types of trolling. And we found that there are certainly different intentions of people who troll. There's the intention to entertain others or amuse. There's no real harm done. But we also found that there were people who engaged in trolling behavior with the intent to harm others.
What were the predictors from the particular types of behaviors and intentions that are linked to behaviours of sociopathy and sadism?
Originally, in some of the earliest research of personality traits of trolls, the dark tetrad of personality was explored, and that includes narcissism, Machiavellianism, which is the tendency to manipulate others, trait psychopathy, which is characterised by callousness, a lack of empathy, impulsivity, and sadism, which is the enjoyment of causing others psychological or physical harm. Now, out of that dark tetrad, traits psychopathy and sadism have emerged as quite reliable predictors of this malevolent form of trolling. So in our study this year, we looked at the utility of psychopathy and sadism to predict trolling, but we were also interested now in the role of self-esteem, as self-esteem has been shown to relate to other antisocial behaviour online. Particularly low self-esteem has been found to predict perpetration of cyberbullying.
And how can we prevent or even avoid perpetration of malevolent trolling in the future?
From the beginnings of research in this area, my intention was never to create a punishment for trolls. My research aimed to basically inform people on how they could manage and prevent this behaviour. So that's really the initial aim that I had, understanding why people might behave this way. Because when we understand the behaviour and motivations behind it, then we can begin to develop successful interventions and management. We can't really manage something successfully if we don't understand why people are doing it in the first place. I've always been careful of the adage, don't feed the trolls, because I do really think that people should be held accountable to their behaviour online. But based on the research results of sadism and the fact that they enjoy causing harm and might even be motivated to get that response, it appears that, yeah, don't feed the trolls is the best way to manage this behaviour.
Dr. Evita March, Senior Lecturer and Researcher of Psychology at Federation University Australia, speaking with The Wire's Jared McLaughlin.
Clouds are rolling in, holding on, such a lonely road. Lightning strikes, it wakes the land, what a lovely sight.
That's a little taste of Songs for Peace, which will be happening this weekend in the far northwest. The Harding River in Roebourne will be the venue for the open-air concert, which is now in its third year. The songs are written by Roebourne community members, young people and inmates from the nearby prison, and sung by leading Indigenous artists. Senior banjima man and singer-songwriter Angus Smith told Annie Haswell all about the event.
The build-up to that was the songwriting workshop we done. Some in the prison, and some back down at the Maroon Centre, which is where we do most of our practicing and preparation work.
How much is the prison a part of the scene there? It sounds like it's kind of integral to the community.
Yeah, well, the prison, because a lot of the prisons are obviously community people, so, and there's a lot of great things happen there, you know, and I guess it's an audience where we really want to catch up with family, and we get some great songs out of that through Big Art, you know, like there's a lot of great songs come out of it, and there are people that, after coming out, they carry on with the program, you know what I mean? It's not just about the music. Music is also... Well, it's our culture. Music is our culture. This is how we keep our history alive. You know, we do it through music, songwriting.
And it's a very healing kind of thing, I imagine, because you can keep your stories going.
Well, if you look at what, I guess, everyday people do, if they're stressed out and troubled, eventually most of them should go and try and get some sort of counselling, I guess. Well, our old people worked that out very, very long time ago, that you need to release what's inside bottling you up. And if it's not just talking to someone, it's definitely writing a song about it, you know. Can be a place of significance to that person or a tribe. And it could be an emotion they're feeling, a hurt. Yeah, or it can be a happy place too. It doesn't have to always be the bad things. It can be good things, you know.
Yeah.
And so music keeps that alive, and music then carries it on basically forever if it's a great song. And if family people look at it and they say, yeah, we like that song, it's a great song, and that person's now passed on, we'll keep that music alive, see, and that's how we carry our history alive.
So do you think for Indigenous people it's closer to their culture to use song and songwriting?
Yep, definitely is.
Comes more naturally?
Yep, and I don't think it should be just for Indigenous people. To me, it's something that every one of us should be doing, you know? We're expressing ourselves. We should be all allowed to express ourselves negatively or positively, but, you know, I don't mean in a harmful way.
I've watched the video and saw some really lovely songs, especially from some of the kids. Are they writing their own material?
Yeah. A lot of the workshop we're doing is we're doing it all together, you know, like the kids are doing their section, the adults are doing theirs. So, yeah, it's a great thing to me because I love music, I love writing songs. And, you know, when you write songs, you can see where people are at with their lives, you know.
How's this Saturday's performance going to work? Because it's the third time you've done it, but this is mid-pandemic. Is it going to be different to the other times?
I believe we might have restrictions in place. I think that's just normal. But it's going to be a community event, as it always has been. And we'll have our time of having meals there. And then we'll just get up, and the community people will be involved with professional musicians. And we'll present what we've been writing in the last 3 to 5 weeks. I think it's 3 or 4 weeks, if I remember.
And I believe you've got some other musicians involved from all over Australia.
Yeah, there's a few musicians who are going to be there. You got Vicky Thorne from The Waits, she's here. Lois Olney, she's here. Lucky Oceans, David Hines. You got Naomi Pigram, John Bennett. Yeah, those are the main acts that we've got.
And will you be performing yourself?
I'll be playing there, yeah. I've done it every year for, I think, I don't know how long I've been part of this, for 4 or 5 years at least. Songs of Peace has only been around for about 3 years, I believe, but we've been doing shows in Robin for a bit while longer, you know?
Give me a sense of what it's going to look like, where it will be, what it will be like.
To me, it feels like it's going to be the best event we ever do. This just feels really positive. The songwriting is really good. There's good quality of song, high quality of songs, and even the professionals that, who are involved with the singing feel that it's going to be a great event, you know. And I'm just glad that in a place where we have so much turmoil, but I mean, Robin's like any other town, I suppose you have the ups and downs. We're uniting with everybody, you know, and we're going to do a presentation of songs of our history.
It's not what we want or what we need. We just want to hang out with the skate park G, chilling in the place of the Robin streets, walking round and round in the summer breeze heat. This is what we do, and this is who we are. Not a bunch of bad people in the Northwest Pilbara.
There's a little taste of some of the songs that will be heard on Saturday night at the Songs for Peace concert in Roebourne. Annie Haswell was talking there to Angus Smith. This year's event will also feature an exclusive video appearance from Paul Kelly and will be a small COVID-safe community event, also live-streamed on NADA Media, which is part of the CBA network. We'll put details on our website. That's that's it for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again, head to our website, thewire.org.au. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is at The Wire Radio. This program is a team effort by 2SER Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear us through your radio or on our podcast every weekday across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Today's show came from the studios of Radio Adelaide.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.